Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to this episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Givan of Sacramento State University, but you can call me Mike. Today's guest is John Roosa, an associate professor of history at the University of British Columbia. He is the author of Pretext for Mass Murder, the September 30th Movement, and the Suharto Coup d'Etat in Indonesia, published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2006. In this book, which is really the definitive account of the confusing, mysterious, and often perplexing events of Indonesia in 1965, he covers the events that led to the downfall of Indonesia's founding president, Sukarno, an anti-imperialist who sought to combine the forces of nationalism, religion, and communism. And he looks at the initial rise of the authoritarian general Suharto, who ruled Indonesia for 32 years, a period of far-right military dictatorship known as the New Order. As part of Suharto's overthrow of Sukarno, he launched and directed a massive campaign of arrest, detention, torture, and mass murder of millions of Indonesians. We don't have the exact number, but somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people were killed, and possibly an equal number sent to brutal prisons throughout the sprawling archipelago, with Buru Island being the most famous. Prisoners worked for years as slave labor. Even after their release, they were subject to official repression and were treated as social pariahs. The children of former prisoners, faced discrimination. Allegedly, this wave of violence was directed at the massive Indonesian Communist Party, the PKI. But in reality, scores of other leftists, including feminists, labor organizers, and artists, fell victim to the bloody purge. Today, we'll be talking about Professor Roosa's new book, Buried Histories, The Anti-Communist Massacres of 1965-1966 in Indonesia, also published with the University of Wisconsin Press this year, 2020. This is a carefully crafted study of these events. Based on decades of interviews and archival research, this book is a welcome addition to the growing scholarly work on what some have termed a political genocide and what a 1968 CIA report called one of the worst mass murders of the 20th century. John Roosa, welcome to New Books in History.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. So I just have to say, for me personally, it's a real honor to have you on the podcast, not only because I've been following your work for years and think very highly of it, but also, just on a personal note, my discovery as a teenager in Honolulu of the history of Indonesia in 1965 is what inspired me to become a historian. And as an undergrad, I wrote my senior thesis on the massacres. Now, as my career unfolded, I wound up spending some 25 years researching colonial Vietnam. But now I'm returning to Cold War Southeast Asia. And I'm very, very happy that the historiography of 1965 is finally really starting to mature. And this book is an important contribution to that. So let me start by asking you how you came to be a specialist in this period of Indonesia 1965 and really what is one of the darkest periods in Indonesian history.
I guess my sort of career path was the mirror image of yours. That is, my start was in South Asian history. It was in a different field. It wasn't in Southeast Asian history. And yet I wound up there in the end. If you started with Indonesia, I ended with Indonesia. That is, I, as a grad student in the 1990s, I was studying South Asian history. But I started visiting Indonesia because my wife is from Indonesia, and that was in the mid-1990s. And her brother became a political prisoner in 1996. And so in 1997, 1998, I was visiting him in prison in Jakarta. And there I met with all the political prisoners being held in that prison, which included Chanana Gusmao, who's now, his role in East Timor has changed over the years, but he's pretty much the sort of, he was the head of the resistance at that time, to the Indonesian occupation. And I met political prisoners who had been held from the late 1960s and even from 1965, who had been affiliated with the Communist Party or the September 30th movement. So I sort of just got a quick crash course in Indonesian history in the mid-1990s, and it became really a kind of fascinating for me, and also, something that I had noticed while taking a minor in Southeast Asian history at the University of Wisconsin was that the literature on the events of 1965-66 was really underdeveloped. And so as soon as I had the chance, I mean, I was thinking already in the mid-1990s, I was thinking, okay, this is an important topic. And if I have a chance to work on it, I will. And so the chance came in 2000, and Suharto resigned in 1998. I had worked in East Timor in 1999 at the time of the referendum as an electoral observer. And so in 2000, I was able to start this kind of oral history research on it. And it was just out of that I was able to sort of make myself a specialist on it. It wasn't something that I had really planned on in graduate school, and that really, I was in terms of Indonesian history, I was still a kind of novice, but I was sort of training myself.
So in the 1990s, when you were in the prison, there were still prisoners from 1965, some 30 years later in the prison?
Yeah, there were three of them. And I befriended all of them. And although I didn't become that close with the famous one amongst them, who was former Colonel Latif, who had been involved in the September 30th movement, by that time, he had already had a stroke and had difficulty speaking. But there was also a sergeant who had been part of the September 30th movement, Bungkus, and another man who had been part of the PKI's special bureau named Asep Suryaman. And so I spoke with Bungkus and Asep Suryaman in later years. As soon as Suharto fell, let's see, they were released, as I remember, is in 1999. And my brother-in-law, too, was released around then as well after Suharto's fall.
That's a fascinating sort of career trajectory for you. That's very unusual, I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, it was a matter of sort of the meetings with activists in Jakarta and meetings with ex-political prisoners and with current political prisoners. That became sort of my school.
Right, for Indonesian history. Fascinating. So let's start with some of the terminology. And there's an active and sometimes heated scholarly debate as to whether or not we should use the term genocide to talk about the mass murders in Indonesia in 1965 and 1966. And I teach courses on this, and my graduate students and I debate this back and forth. And to be honest with you, I change my mind maybe twice a week on this subject. So I don't really have a dog in this fight, so to speak. But where do you stand on the terminology? I mean, do you even find the debate worthwhile? And could you explain to the readers sort of what's at stake in this debate as to whether or not Indonesia 65 was a genocide or not?
Yeah. It's not a big priority for me, partly because my interest is really trying to figure out how these killings occurred and what kind of killings they were. That is, so in some ways, to have a debate over exactly how to call this event presumes that we know what the event is. And there's a lot of things about this event that I'm calling it sort of one big event that are really, really obscure and that people don't agree on. And even scholars really don't, of specialists on Indonesian history, don't have a good sense about. So, for instance, the key issue of terminology for me is to move beyond just this term mass killings, because I'm calling them mass disappearances. With mass killings, we get the sense of, villagers rampaging in the streets, killing their neighbors, that kind of thing. Or a riot and in cities, riots in cities where people are coming out of the neighborhoods, the kampongs, and just massacring people. And that, is sort of along the lines of what happened in 1998 in Jakarta and some other cities with these urban riots. We don't get a sense of how these killings were actually killings of detainees. And that's one of the main points of the book, is to show that these, when we talk about mass killings, what we're actually talking about are executions, extrajudicial executions of detainees who hadn't even been charged with a crime, but just taken out of prison in truckloads and then massacred. And then their families were never told what happened to them. And in the public usually was not informed as well. So, I mean, it wasn't completely secret. It was what I call an open secret. But still, this was, a largely secret operation, such that there was great confusion about who was killing or sort of who was killing whom, who were the victims, what happened to the victims, where the graves were, where the bodies were, and so forth. So that's sort of my concern in the book. And ultimately, I think you can call it a genocide, even if it doesn't strictly follow the UN definition. Again, so it depends on how you define genocide, really. And it can be a political genocide, a politicide. I'm not too concerned about it. What I am concerned is that we do integrate this event that happened in Indonesia with a global history of genocide, mass atrocity, whatever you want to call it, so that we're not just sort of saying, oh, well, this isn't a genocide, so we don't have to compare it to the Armenian genocide or any other genocide in history. This is something uniquely Indonesian, and it was kind of inscrutable, and people just did it because, well, that's Indonesia, is some sort of undeveloped country, that this is where violence is normal or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sort of Orientalist mythology around 65-66, which I think you touch on several times in the book. I mean, this idea of, oh, well, Indonesians just go amok, and it's something, I'm using scare quotes here, but some darkness in the Malay soul or something. Not treating the perpetrators as rational actors.
And not looking at the victims, not understanding what the victims too were thinking about at the time, how they were strategizing, how they understood their situation. And so if you, take away all of this, these accretions of upon the Orientalist lens upon on Indonesia, as possible to see, Indonesia is very much, fitting into patterns that exist everywhere else in times of mass violence or mass atrocities.
Your work makes this case sound much more like the Khmer Rouge than other representations of Indonesian violence that I'd seen before. Especially this idea of, killing detainees. I mean, that's very much like the violence and the executions centered around Tool Sling, the Khmer Rouge genocide or a torture center that was what's now the Genocide Museum. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned before, and as you mentioned, there was for decades, there was relatively little scholarly work on 1965. And now there's a series of, really excellent books. Yours, Jeffrey Robinson's book, Annie Pullman, Kate McGregor and Doug Kamen, Vincent Hierman, Ariel Herianto, and Jess Melvin from scholars. In addition to that, there's a recent book by the journalist Vincent Bevins and the films. I mean, they're really incredible films by Joshua Oppenheimer, The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence. And also a film that's probably less well known by Robert Lemelson, 40 Years of Silence. So just in the past, eight years, there's been this sort of flourishing of all this work. And so why is this happening now, 40, 50 years after the events in question? And why didn't it happen sooner?
Well, I think all of these works are really based upon research that has only begun after 1998. So it's just been a kind of accumulation of material as scholars are able to devote more time to it and interview more people from the time, uncover documents here and there. So in a sense, this book is overdue. I had planned it to come out a long time ago. Some of the interviews go back 20 years, but it was very difficult to write about disappearances that were meant not to be known. I mean, my earlier book was about an event that was, as you said, mysterious, the September 30th movement. But still, it was sort of one particular event, and much about it was known, and there's a fairly large number of people who had written on it and had opinions on it, and so it was a little bit more manageable actually to write about that. But with this book is about the killings that happened after that, and given that the killings were largely these disappearances, it's just very difficult to study those. When you have to triangulate information, you have to be able to get some corroboration of the information that you get, and that's often very difficult to do. And so there's a lot of stories that I have that I just wound up not putting in the book because I didn't feel confident enough in them. And even though, the sort of stories that I think are true, but I just didn't want to put in, maybe I'll find some other way of talking about them. But think about, how these disappearances occurred, where there are people being held in prison, hundreds or thousands of people being held in a prison, and then they're called one night, 40, 50 people put onto a truck and then taken out, massacred in a kind of remote place, put in a mass grave. There's very few witnesses left to tell the story. And sometimes, you know, we only get a stray witness, somebody who happened to be in the truck to help out with the digging of the grave, or a local person who had been involved in digging the grave, or a prisoner who happened to escape. That's actually in The Look of Silence. One of the people who talks about the killings is somebody who managed to duck out as the prisoners were being marched to the execution site. And so the perpetrators haven't been forthcoming in saying, this is what we did. And Oppenheimer's films are, you know, one of the first places where we see the perpetrators talk about saying, this is what we did. But in many other parts of Indonesia, you won't find perpetrators willing to be so open about saying, yes, we received batches of prisoners and this is where we killed them. Mm-hmm. And even in that, in his films, you'll notice there's a lot of perpetrators who are pulling back and saying, no, this isn't, we can't talk about this, or the family members denying it. So disappearances by their very nature are meant to defy historical investigation. You know, and since Suharto stayed in power for 32 years, we're talking about events that occurred so long ago that it's really difficult to get reliable information about them.
Right. So can you tell us a bit more about your research methodology under these circumstances? I mean, the archives are, to say the least, more than a little difficult to gain access to, although you do have some archival work in here, and it's mostly oral testimonies, some of which are very, very powerful. So what kind of archival work can be done? And also, how do you do oral histories in this setting that is so fraught?
Well, I could speak for a long time on this, so I'm trying to figure out how to say something succinct. I guess I'll just describe what I did. First, I worked with a team of Indonesian researchers, and these were peers of mine, as well as some younger people who had been involved in working with the victims of the 1998 riots in Jakarta. So it wasn't really my research, that is, it was a collective project, and having that many people involved was really crucial because, you know, for instance, one of the researchers lived in a kampung in Jakarta, and we started by interviewing his uncle, who was a former political prisoner, and he didn't know exactly what happened with his uncle. And it was just in the course of the interviewing that he learned a lot about how his uncle had become a political prisoner. We interviewed a fellow selling herbal drinks in front of the cinema who had been a former political prisoner. We interviewed a fellow in the neighborhood who was selling fried bananas from a cart. He had been a former political prisoner. And so it was sort of just beginning with relatives and friends and acquaintances of the people who were part of this research team. There were about 10 of us, our friends. I had known ex-political prisoners from the first time I'd come to Indonesia, actually. And I met Pramodya Natatur in 1995. And who's a well-known Indonesian writer. And so there were other political prisoners, the ones I had met in the prison, in Cipinang prison, that were being held up until 1998 or 1999. So part of it was kind of a snowball effect. And, you know, we would ask these people, okay, what to do. And at this time in 2000, 2001, 2002, it was pretty open because the state was in such flux. It was the political elite were really confused about what to do after Suharto had resigned and there were these mass riots. And there was a lot of effort for political reform. And there were new journals starting up and newspapers starting up all the time. And there was a lot of ferment. And at the same time, there were victims' organizations coming up. That is, people who had been political prisoners were really coming out for the first time as well and forming their own organizations and debating about what they wanted and getting into quite a lot of disagreements as well as to what their agenda should be. So we were able to take advantage of that as well by contacting these people who were willing to self-identify as victims and come forward to the public. And pretty much in every city and small town in Java and Bali and Sumatra, there were at least a few people like this who were willing to sort of come forward and appear in public and say, I'm a former political prisoner. My rights have been violated. I would like to speak. So it was sort of the right time to do it as well. And but it wasn't the case where we could just come out and advertise openly and say, we're looking for prisoners, former political prisoners to interview. And the nature of the research was such that it had to be have low profile still. Even though it was kind of more open situation, there were still some concerns about the security. And so we took a lot of precautions there to ensure that the material would be anonymous and that we would use pseudonyms and for people who did not want to have their names to be public.
Yeah. I mean, I just can imagine a nerve-wracking that may have been. And then also the psychological consequences of, you know, facilitating these oral interviews and asking people to revisit these times of trauma. So, you know, I've heard some really interesting stories about the chance events people have had in the archives. I think it's Jess Melvin in Aceh who they accidentally gave her sort of the dossier with all the that laid everything out. And I think we have a friend in common, Bonnie Triana, Historia Magazine, who as an undergraduate went into the military archives in Semarang and just kind of talked his way into letting them see the secret documents. In the book, you mentioned that there's were they possibly misfiled dossiers from Bali, or
Well, I think what you're referring to is a collection that the National Archives has opened up that was from a military organization called COTI and Comando Operasi Tertinggi that existed at that time. And COTI, it turned out, became kind of a clearinghouse for documents that had been seized from PKA offices and the homes of various PKA leaders. And so I got the Excel spreadsheet with the list of the documents, and some of them are, you know, like a book by Lenin. they would grab all kinds of stuff, but it showed that they were confiscating or looting, stealing all of these personal documents as well of the prisoners, and so it's all quite unethical. There was a man in Bali whose home was raided by a mob, and they stole all of his personal documents that were in the home. And some of those appear in the archive. and there was personal correspondence with his daughter and so forth. And so there was that that I was able to access. I interviewed many of the members of his family in Bali and many of his acquaintances. He was a well-known person prior to 1965, prior to his execution in late 1965. So there were these sort of chance stray documents in the archives, but in general, there's very little from the archives that has come to light.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So the book is really organized into two parts. There's the first three chapters, which are on the struggle for hegemony between the army and the PKI. The army's propaganda campaign, and the use of torture. Then there are four case studies with a chapter on Solo or Surakarta, two chapters on Bali, and a chapter on Sumatra. So why did you choose to organize the book in this way?
In the first part, I wanted to try to get at the subjectivity of the perpetrators, and I wanted to get at this problem of how these people could interpret what was going on around them as a war. Because that's the usual rendering amongst the perpetrators of what was happening. They were saying this was a time of war. We were about to be killed, that this was self-defense, that they would have killed us if they had the chance. And that's this sort of common line, kind of universal line. And I wanted to make a claim about the truth of what happened on this score, to say that it was not a war and that the PKI was not engaged in a revolt, and that the very fact that so many of them could be killed was precisely due to the fact that they were not engaged in a revolt, that they were loyal to the state, that when they were arrested, they went to prison. They thought that they would be, you know, released soon enough, that they felt that they had done nothing wrong, and they were surprised to find that they were grabbed from prison and executed in such large numbers. And so that was, it's not a war when you're killing prisoners. That's just not a war. And so I wanted to really go against this existing narrative that is so prevalent, not just in Indonesia, but outside of Indonesia as well, that this was some kind of war or political conflict, two sides going against each other, and you know, one side happened to win, and that's, you know, this is inexcusable, right? You the killing of prisoners is one of these absolutes that if it happened as a kind of rare occurrence within the general campaign of repression against the PKI. Okay, you know, there might be some, but this was systematic. This was across the country, from Aceh in the far west to Flores in the far east. I mean, and the patterns are fairly similar too. This was, that people who did not have to be killed were being killed. And it's there's no way to justify it. This was an atrocity. I mean, that's sort of one of the main points of the book. And so the question there, though, is how the perpetrators could interpret it as a time of war when everything they see is telling them it's not. but this propaganda, which is circulating within the army itself and not just in the public, but the stories that are being told within the army and then being retailed in the newspapers to the public, that has an effect of helping to convince people that, no, this really is a war, that even if you don't see it, it's there. Maybe it's not in your immediate environment, but this is a national level thing. The PKI is in the revolt. So I think it's important to, it's the sort of general's knowledge among scholars is that this was propaganda. I'm not saying anything fundamentally new, but I am trying to show just how absurd this propaganda was, how mistaken it was, but that also it helped to have this effect, that it was sort of lubrication for the killing machine to get perpetrators to see, to think that the PKI was engaged in a revolt, that this was a war, and they had to be on a war footing. It somewhat reminds me of today, where, you know, peaceful demonstrators on the streets in the United States now are being seen by some officials in Washington as terrorists, as people who need to be suppressed with troops. Tom Cotton has called for the military to come out. Trump was as well. The defense secretary said, this is a battle space. It's not a battle space. these are peaceful protesters in the streets. But this jump then from kind of a civil politics to war is what is interesting. And that's what I wanted to get at in chapters 2 and 3.
Yeah, no, we're recording this, these are COVID times, so I've lost all sense of date, but we're recording this June 8th. And so I was reading this last week as all the events were happening, and the absolute insanity of the president talking about this Antifa boogeyman, and the president coming out against anti-fascists, and which is just a loose collection of various leftist activists, which I would consider myself part of. Reading this book in that context led to a few sleepless nights. And the parallels today were just, they're terrifying. So let's get into the chapters. So the first chapter, you describe the conflicts between the PKI, the Indonesian Communist Party, and the army. And I really like the way that you theorized it. You describe it as a Gramscian struggle for hegemony. Can you quickly explain this to us and expand upon this?
Yeah, I'll try. I guess a key point that I wanted to make there in the opening chapter, in chapter one, was about the importance of guided democracy from 1959 to 1965. We're sort of setting the stage for a conflict between the PKI and the army. If you looked at Indonesia in 1959, you would not have predicted that sort of political conflict in 6 years would just be a kind of binary conflict between the PKI and the army. So there's a lot that's going on in guided democracy. For the PKI, it becomes a really large organization. That is, up until 1959, it's a it was the fourth largest party about. In Central Java, it was the largest. But in a lot of areas of Indonesia, it wasn't that powerful. It didn't seem like this sort of massive political force that it did in 1965. So there's a big growth of the PKI during this period. And then there's a greater penetration of the army into the civil society at the same time. The army creates what it calls a territorial command. And I put this in the first chapter and appears in the last chapter as well. And it's a kind of big theme of the book because it's something that's, it's, I don't know how unique it is, but it's pretty unusual to have an army organized like the Indonesian army, where it has active duty personnel serving as a kind of supra police force within the society. And it still exists today. And there's no signs that it's going to be removed either. There are some people today within the army who are reformers who are thinking really the territorial structure or territorial command doesn't serve the military very well because it isn't really the military's business to be policing the society. That, you know, the reformers are saying we should, the military should be more professional. The army should get out of. Start moving in that direction, closing some of these commands down. But the army is heavily invested in this existing system, and so it continues to this day, even though the conditions for its emergence at back in the late 50s, early 60s, no longer obtain. So, I mean, it was meant, this territorial command, it was meant to deal with the PKI. That was one of its main functions. That's how it was organized in the late 50s and early 60s as a kind of parallel to the PKI. And it really mirrored the PKI in many ways and set up its own organizations of and promoted or anti-communist organizations to rival the PKI. So that's when the killings begin then in late 65, it's the territorial command. It's these army personnel who are based in the villages, districts, the provinces. It's hard for me to explain quickly, but the territorial command is, you can see it as a kind of adjunct to the civilian administration. Imagine any civilian administration of a government, and then imagine just attaching at every level an army officer to it.
It's a parallel or a shadow apparatus. I mean,
I guess a parallel is better because it's not in the shadows. It's up front. It's there. Everybody knows about it.
Also opens the possibility for many officers to get involved in local economic projects and to amass economic interests.
Yeah, and that's a big reason why it continues. It's just because there's the funding that it provides for the army, which is, you know, not from the government. It means that the army has its own kind of power that any civilian president coming in has a really hard time going against this entrenched army, which has its own sources of funding.
Right. In the 50s and into guided democracy, which is this period where the president Sukarno suspends elections and he guides democracy. What is the PKI strategy? I mean, is this like the Viet Minh? Is this an insurgency? Do they have a massive army? Are they training militias?
Yeah, so this is what I was arguing about, you know, the Gramscian character of the PKI. And I think, you know, it's kind of a shame that a lot of the literature on Gramsci has been so Eurocentric and hasn't considered the PKI. So because the PKI, everybody knows, was, you know, the largest communist party by 1965 outside of the communist, you know, where there were communist states. And it was a peaceful, organization of people. That is peaceful, you know, they didn't have an armed wing, I should say. They would carry out strikes. Strikes involve a kind of contestation of force, but really it is, you know, protected. It's peaceful. It can be considered a kind of civil conflict. It's not a military conflict. And the PKI used the term hegemony, the sort of classic Gramscian term, and saw by 1965 that it acquired a kind of hegemony by what it called a peaceful offensive, and that it was doing a really good job of putting Gramsci's ideas to work, even though there's no evidence that anybody in the PKI knew about Gramsci. But it followed very much a Gramscian playbook of, you know, organizing different sectors of society and creating kind of trenches where you have strong support for the party. There's a women's organization, a peasant organization, there's a students organization, there's a youth organization, there's, you know, all these different kinds of organizations.
The artist organization, LECRA.
There were artists, and it allowed some autonomy for some of these organizations, but it was sort of guiding the leadership of the different organizations. And then it was, it had its own newspaper. It infiltrated some of the other political parties and got the other political parties to align with its agenda. So it was really, you know, and it had the president's ear. So it was moving in this sort of Gramscian, with a Gramscian agenda. And it was very successful in it. And so one of my sort of side pleas in this, or one point in that chapter is just to say, you know, if you're interested in Gramsci, you should look at the PKI.
No, that's great. And yes, so much of the literature is Eurocentric. And the PKI is just such an remarkably different case study of what we think about in terms of communist parties during the Cold War, especially in the global South, because they do not have a military arm. They're want to stand in elections. They're actually probably the biggest losers with the suspension of elections, because they were doing so well. So anyway, so that just to set the stage for those who are unfamiliar with Indonesian history, in 1950s, 1960s, you have this increased sort of polarization between the PKI on the left and the army on the right, and the images of, you know, the cliched image is Sukarno's balancing these two. And then there's this event that's the subject of your first book, on the night of September 30th, a handful of generals are kidnapped and murdered. And this is really an internal army affair. Please let's not go into the details of it because it's so complicated. Read Pretext for Mass Murder. It lays it all out very clearly for this complicated history. And almost immediately, the army led by what's really arguably an upstart general, Suharto, launches this anti-PKI, anti-communist crusade, and blames the PKI for the murder of these generals. And a huge phantasmagoria of violent fantasies, correct? Mm-hmm. So chapter two is about the propaganda that the army, now directed by Suharto, pushed out. Tell us about the propaganda machine.
I thought I needed to spell it out in some detail because the... It's often sometimes difficult to believe the kinds of stories that they were telling in the media. You know, I have to sort of, I read through the two army newspapers day by day, and I cite a lot of the articles just to create this picture. I want people to be able to see in some depth the picture of this propaganda, and just how crazy it was, and how mendacious it was as well. But another part of that is the chapter is called mental operations, and that was the term that the Indonesian army used. And this Psy War was really a military operation, and so it followed definite protocols. It was sort of a very systematic thing. They had an idea, a sort of a narrative that they wanted to present. And so they organized this mental operation in the same way that they would organize a war, the way they would put soldiers into a battlefield. So the army had total control over the media, and then it created this perception that everybody in the PKI had been part of the September 30th movement, was engaged in a revolt, and that they were evil and they presented a mortal threat to all non-communists. And so all of a sudden, people who were your next-door neighbor, who you had always gone along with, all of a sudden they became the sort of rabid animal, which is a term that a U.S. official used for protesters recently. That is, the dehumanization was very quick. And so you can imagine this happening in any state where the army is able to gain this position of having total control over the media and total control over the state, such that there's very little countervailing force to that operation.
So one of the aspects of the army propaganda that really stood out to me was the gender component and the vilification of women associated with the Communist Party and the Gerwani movement. And importantly, Gerwani is this women's organization that's actually not directly tied to the PKI. They're really more fellow travelers. Why was the gender aspect of this so important, and why was there this concerted campaign to vilify these women?
Yeah, well, I think Saskia Wierdinga has written insightfully about this, so I won't say much. But on this particular score, but the I think what's important to note is that it was a way of saying to the Indonesian public, look, the PKI has upended our patriarchal norms. It's a way of getting all the men in the country to see the PKI as being a threat to their own power. So it becomes not just sort of a threat to the state. The PKI is not just a political threat to the state, but really it's a threat to the patriarchal order. And, you know, the absurd thing was that Gerwani were largely sort of middle class, lower middle class. It's hard to, you know, give a clear-cut class description of Indonesia at the time, but they were sort of educated women who were engaged in anti-illiteracy campaigns and who were actually talking a lot about how to be a good wife. They weren't at all. You know, there wasn't even a hint of the kind of behavior that the army was alleging. So of course that's just absurd. And the PKI also, as a party, had a reputation for being against womenizing. That was a problem, and people got kicked out of the party for that. There was a very prominent artist, one of the best painters ever in Indonesia, who was kicked out of the party because he left his wife and started living with another woman. And that was against the rules. And it was clearly against, that was one thing that party leaders would be investigated on. They were kind of a puritanical party in that regard. They did not tolerate, flagrant kinds of what was called womanizing.
Yeah. And it's so shocking because if you go to see the National Ideology Monument, the Manchisila in Lubangwaya, the museum that commemorates this, the image of PKI women is as sexually loose. Their hair is down. In this very famous statue, one of them literally has her butt sort of coming out of the screen or out of the bas relief, and there's another that has her top is very low. It's completely at odds with what actually was the sort of the cultural bearing of these individuals.
Yeah, so that was part of the mental operations, yes. And those images were like central, right at the center of that monument of the bas relief.
Yeah, and the monument's still there. It's still there to this day, and it's the sacred national ideology monument. It is above reproach. You may not criticize this. So chapter three, which for me personally was the most difficult chapter to read, you discuss the systematic use of torture, and you make an argument I think many scholars of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia will find actually quite valuable. When they try to make sense of the Kafka-esque transcripts from the tool sling genocide torture and interrogations. And if I understand it right, you hold that the torturers, the army torturers, were trying to put their dark fantasy into reality, to make their lies real by forcing people under torture to admit to these absurd claims. Can you speak on this and what you add to the sort of history of torture?
Yeah. So when we were conducting oral interviews with former political prisoners, the standard story was that at some point after their capture, it wasn't really official arrest, but maybe we can call it arrest. But after their capture or arrest, they would be interrogated. And the interrogation, was premised on the idea that the PKI was engaged in a war, that it was engaged in a rebellion, an armed rebellion, and therefore everybody had to be interrogated so that the army would know where the enemy was, where the guns were, what their plans were. And so they would interrogate every single person that they detained, and torture was standard operating procedure. It wasn't used on every single person, but it was standard operating procedure. So this, what it meant though, was that then that idea that the PKI was engaged in rebellion became confirmed, because the interrogators were forcing people to give information as if the PKI was engaged in war. So I look at torture not as an extraction of information, but as an imposition of information. And so I think that, we usually hear, critiques of torture along the lines of, well, it doesn't work. It doesn't, but that's premised on the idea that it's not a good way of extracting information. But actually, it's a very good way of imposing information and of getting the story of confirming the kind of narrative that you have to understand what's going on in the world. And one of the sort of theoretical points in the chapter is a critique of Elaine Scarry's work on torture, which actually I think very highly of, but and I think it has a lot of validity. But torture is she thinks is just about getting sort of revenge or having the power to inflict pain upon the enemy, somebody construed as the enemy. as compensatory violence, compensating for the lack of state power that had occurred outside the torture room. But and she treats the verbal exchange as not that important, as the whatever information, the information is just a kind of excuse to inflict pain. But in this case, the Indonesian army took the information from the torture chambers and circulated it and said, here's proof. Here's proof that the PKI is engaged in a revolt. Here's proof that what we were claiming is right. And so they would use transcripts from interrogation sessions that were accompanied by torture as though this was proof of their claims, so that the, in a sense, the imposition of information worked really well in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think that's a really important sort of complement to, say, David Chandler's book on Voices from S21 about the the Cambodian torture center. And he's sort of perplexed in the book. He's sort of perplexed, like, why would they do this? They know this is all nonsense, yet they were forcing these people to say this nonsense. But it's, again, it's to create this narrative that they're trying to to create this narrative.
I think anytime the state does that and says torture is okay, and that this is, we're going to practice torture during interrogations, they're sort of admitting that they don't care about the truthfulness of any information, and because they're just removing any standard that they have for deciding what is true and what isn't. When states, we have to think about torture as this bureaucratic exercise, and you can see it in the Tulsang case as well, the S21 case as well in Cambodia, that it creates this feedback loop, a self-confirming feedback loop, where even if the state officials at the start said, well, we don't really know if this is true or not, they keep getting reports saying, yes, the KGB is sabotaging rice production or something, that there's this conspiracy that's of some teenagers that are opposed to us that we have to crush. And they can't tell anymore. And this is, what's true or not. But any of these interrogation reports are kind of worthless in terms of trying to understand what's true or false. And so they sort of, the torture creates this self-confirming feedback loop, I guess.
All right. Yeah. So the next four chapters are your case studies. You look at Surakarta, also known as Solo, two chapters on Bali, and then a chapter on sort of greater Sumatra. First off with Solo, why did you pick Surakarta as a case study? What's significant about Solo and Central Java?
Yeah, well, I should say that within Solo, there was a really good organization of victims that was doing a lot of work after 1998. And my colleagues and I really enjoyed working with them, getting to know them, talking with them. And we were able to organize not just individual interviews, but also a kind of a one-day gathering of about 60 former political prisoners who then had a kind of community discussion about the events that happened in the city. And there were all kinds of different stories that came up there, and people could, at that meeting, sort of correct one another or compliment one another to compliment the information, add more information, confirm various parts of the story. So our interviewing in solo became sort of fairly rich. And but that's also because up until 1965, solo and the area around it was really the most important base for the PKI. That is, there were districts there where the mayor of Solo was pro-PKI, and then the what are called the Bhupatis are PKI members. So there are a lot of members of the government, or officials in the government, who were PKI supporters or PKI members. And the PKI in 1955, the first national elections, won some of these areas by a landslide, with more than twice the number of votes as the nearest party, as the second-ranked party. So this was where there were a lot of people who supported the PKI. And so one of the aims of that chapter was also to indicate how the PKI became popular, that it really was a kind of central Javanese phenomenon. The center of gravity for the party was in central Java. And so later, when we look at Sumatra, we see how there are these links back to central Java. So it was the kind of area where being a communist was just considered normal. It wasn't like some strange fringe party at all. It wasn't, this was really well integrated into the society. And so the question is, how could the PKI defeat it? How could the PKI be, how could its members, a sort of Gramscian struggle for hegemony, have been so successful? And it's a question that I don't think the literature has really addressed all that well. And my book isn't, sort of the final answer by any means on it. There's a lot more that could be said on this issue. But I did want to indicate something about, and this is a kind of a question that every political activist will have, is to think, well, how could the party allow this to happen? What was the party thinking at the time? And so trying to show how people within the party, in a place where the party was at its strongest, where ID, the head of the party, actually fled after the failure of the September 30th movement and was hiding in the area around Solo, that the farmers there just had no inkling that this was going to happen. They were taken by surprise. There's another aim in the chapter there. I'm sorry, the chapter is probably tries to do too much, but there's a big section there on the September 30th movement in Solo. And it's you kind of need to read Pretext just to appreciate the significance of that section. But there is a critique there of the Cornell paper, which was the sort of, for Indonesianists, the sort of famous essay written by Ben Anderson and Ruth McVeigh that said that really the September 30th movement was a movement of central Javanese military officers that the PKI really didn't know anything about. And so I'm showing from the view of a pro-PKI military officer, an army officer who was involved in the September 30th movement in Solo, that it really was coming out of the PKI Special Bureau, that the PKI Special Bureau was getting them to do these things and they didn't understand. And that's sort of why the movement failed so well, so spectacularly. So there's a section there that's actually kind of confirming what I was arguing in Pretext for Mass Murder. So that's all I have to check.
But the surprise and that that they would be slaughtered was unimaginable to the rank and file PKI members was just such a powerful assessment finding from your case study of Solo. So you've got two chapters on Bali, And you do a number of things there. And in the first one, you look at sort of the general pattern of disappearances in particular. In the second chapter, you focus on a massacre. And one of the things that really stood out for me in these two chapters was that you argue for adding a new category to sort of the genocide trinity of victim, perpetrator, and witness. You talk about the importance of resistors, and you find these examples in Bali. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, so there were the governor of Bali, as well as the army commander within the territorial structure that covered Bali, the Kodam that was based in Bali. These two officials were supporting Sukarno, and Sukarno was trying to prevent the mass killings from happening, and he was telling everybody who would listen to him not to kill, not to have this allow the kind of killing that Suharto's group was organizing. So there was a duality within the state at the time. And so the pro-Sukarno officials were not following sort of encouragement from Suharto's group in Jakarta to carry out mass killings. So they wind up being overthrown. That is, well, the governor is removed in early December, and then the army commander is just bypassed. And the Jakarta Army High Command, the general staff of Suharto, comes to Bali, and then they introduce troops from Jakarta and organize the slaughter with the Koram, which is one step below the Kodam. And so the newspaper that was publishing in Bali at the time covered this fairly well, and the publishing a lot of the information from the army saying, okay, this is how this operation should go. This is who we should target. This is how we should proceed, without saying we're going to kill anyone, but it's always, you know, crush the PKI and the September 30th movement. So there were these people who were resisting, and it went down to the village level. So in Bali, there were the village heads who were also trying to prevent the killing. And there were, in one village that I studied, not only did the village head try to prevent the, you know, he sheltered some of the PKI members or supporters within the village in his own compound. When the army later came to the village and said, here's, you know, about a dozen detainees that we want you to kill and dispose of, he said, no, I'm not going to do it. We've already done killing. We've had enough. So there were these kinds of ways that people within the government could resist.
Yep. And then in your last case study on Sumatra, you're looking primarily at southern and sort of southeastern Sumatra. You talk about how the massacres were really an assault on the unions. And this is an often neglected aspect of the history of 1965. So could you say a bit more about how Suharto's bloodletting was a war on organized labor?
Yeah, thanks for that question, because I do think this is an important point. That is, we often look at these events as just a political matter between the PKI and the army, and PKI and various anti-communist parties. The PKI, as it existed in 1965, is part of that Gramscian struggle for hegemony, had really taken control over a lot of the big unions. And so the Railway Workers Union, the Oil Workers Union, and there was also a Plantation Workers Union, were all affiliated to the PKI. And the army had been involved in the years before 1965 in helping sort of plantation owners, factory owners and managers undermine the PKI. So in October 1965, they just started rounding up all of these union activists who had been pretty powerful before them. And, you know, it's one thing that I don't think comes out in a lot of the histories about the violence, is about sort of what was happening before and how important these, or how powerful these unions were. For Sumatra, what was the important industry was oil. I mean, that was big, big foreign exchange earner for Indonesia. And that was, you know, Caltex was there, a lot of Shell was there, multinational oil companies were there, and they were facing oil workers' unions who really had a sense of power deriving from their participation in the national struggle for independence. And so that chapter is to indicate how for workers in 1965, their reference is back to the struggle for independence, that they had been involved in that struggle and that they had a claim then to having rights in this new country of Indonesia where they didn't have rights before, where they were not citizens of the state, where they were under racist laws from the Japanese colonial period to the to the Dutch before them. So this was a kind of, you know, a sense amongst workers in the 1950s and 60s that they were really coming into their own for once. And then Suharto's crackdown on them represented a return to a lot of these colonial era systems of oppression, where they were denied rights to organize altogether. There was no independent unionizing after 1965. And this whole story, I think, has to be fit within any kind of literature of genocide, that in genocide, we often don't deal with this kind of, you know, sort of economics of the genocide.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there's a few parallels in East Java around sugarcane plantations and some of the sugarcane workers and the way their unions were crushed as well. So in the conclusion, you lay out these three groups that are really responsible for the massacres. The Army High Command, Suharto and his inner circle of generals, the Kodam, the regional territorial commanders, and the civilian militias. Could you just say a few words on each and their various levels of responsibility and also their interactions?
Yeah, so as I see it, you know, the killings take place where there is a kind of level of cooperation between these three. So the Army High Command is not actually insisting to the army officers in every part of Indonesia that they have to kill. They're encouraging them to kill. They're inciting them to kill. The propaganda line says killing is okay. They are intervening in certain places, like Bali, to have the killing take place. But they're allowing quite a lot of places and on the island of Borneo, in Kalimantan, in Sulawesi, and some in West Java, even in West Java, to continue without mass killings of PKI supporters. So the Army High Command is there with its pressure on lower level officers to kill. But it's a lot is up to the Kodam commander. There are 16 Kodams. These are army regions covering the country. And it's up to the Kodam commander really to make decisions about whether the killing of detainees should take place or not. And this is where I do want to sort of orient our attention. What I want people to pay attention to is that there's a decision at some point of army officers. And I think the Kodam commander is the key one, but there's others to look at, to say we're not going to just arrest people and hold them anymore. We're going to, all these people that we're holding, we're going to start killing off a lot of them. In Bali, we're going to kill off all of them. That was the line there. So the military officials bear a key responsibility for making these decisions. The civilian militias, they can provide a kind of push to encourage the army to make a decision in favor of killing, as they did in Bali, as they appear to have done in West Sumatra and in Riau in Sumatra. But they're not the ones really making the decisions. And when they do go out and kill, it's not like they can kill a lot of people. That once you have this kind of mass killing, it really relies upon army officers who are in charge of the prisons to make this decision. Okay, we're going to kill off the detainees. The civilian militias play a key role in helping them when they're called upon to say we need help in, you know, the manpower to arrange these killings. They help out. But I think their role has been greatly exaggerated in the existing literature.
Mm-hmm. And in this final section you have on afterlives, you talk about the various attempts to revise the Suharto era narrative of 65 and the killings. The Indonesian scholar Joseph Jacobaba calls the Lubang Buaya narrative. And you note that these attempts at a more just, a more accurate, a more honest inquiry into this history keep getting crushed. Why is this happening 50 years after the events in question and some 22 years after the fall of Suharto?
Well, I guess the easiest way to answer that is just to say the territorial structure, the territorial command of the army is still around. And this is all that they really know how to do, is keep track of anybody talking about the PKI. So if there's some young students who want to have a discussion about my book, about Joshua Oppenheimer's films, about anything having to do with this history, there's always some army, local army officer, or you know, lower level ranking soldier who's there who can intervene and stop it. That's what they're geared to do, is just pay attention to any kind of what they call communist activity within their area, even when it's not. So they have a sort of vested interest in keeping up this whole story about how the PKI is still around, still a danger. They have these old senior citizens, you know, in their 70s and 80s who were former political prisoners meeting together, and their meetings get raided by the army. And they're still in the press these days. These issues of, just over the past week, there have been a lot of stories about, is the PKI rising again? What's the evidence? There's a government official who's getting into trouble for discounting the the idea that the PKI is a threat, you know. And so it's still a live issue, largely, I think, because the army wants it to remain a live issue. And the army needs to justify this territorial command, which I think, and there's a lot of people in Indonesia who think but can't say it, that it's largely superfluous, and that the Indonesian army could become more of a kind of professional army. It could withdraw from civil society and allow just sort of the regular workings of a government to continue with the civil administration and the police, that they don't really need to be there, but they sort of have to justify their presence in this name. Just this past week, the president, Jokowi, said, or one of his officials, his justice minister, said that he might issue an apology to the PKI. And this was something that Jokowi had been thinking about before, but he was sabotaged back in 2016. And that's one of the key issues in that final chapter, Afterlives, is how he was sabotaged and how he just sort of gave up on it. And I guess now that he's talking about this apology, he's feeling a bit more confident about his power now, that he figures he can get away with this, even though it's all kind of ridiculous to talk about an apology to the PKI. The PKI doesn't exist anymore. And it's an apology to everybody who was a victim of disappearances. I mean, I think that's the key issue, that there has to be some acknowledgement in Indonesia of the disappearances. And, you know, this book is actually meant largely for an Indonesian audience, because it will have many more readers in Indonesia than it has elsewhere. And so there are, you know, particular arguments that I've crafted in a way to, because I'm thinking about an Indonesian audience. I'm not just thinking about an audience of fellow scholars, but this is going to become a kind of public property in Indonesia. So, and in doing so, I've also tried to think about the emotional impact of the book. So, unlike Pretext, this book, I think, has more of a kind of an effective side to it, and meaning a kind of an emotional side to it, where I was trying to be pretty conscious about getting people to feel the horror of what happened, not just sort of appreciate it analytically and not just to say that it's a horror, but through the personal stories that were presented, to get people to feel this really was a tragedy, and that this is something that we can't just talk about in sort of political science terms, or I should say, you know, sort of conventional political science terms of PKI and the army and so forth. But I didn't want to be melodramatic about it or present it as purely just isolated cases of this individual going through a traumatic moment, but to integrate that that appreciation for the horror of what happened with the kind of explanation of how that could occur.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do that quite effectively. I mean, it is some of the, in the title, Buried Histories, and then some of the images throughout the book, and what you conclude with this idea of these bodies being under the soil and thrown into the rivers, and you know, really in many ways just sort of haunting the history of and landscape of Indonesia. So I noticed in Buried Histories that there's relatively little about the United States, Great Britain, or Australia, and the role of their intelligence agencies in these massacres. And this would be in contrast to the famous Ramparts article from several decades ago, or the work of Peter Scott Dale, and even you could say Bradley Simpson's work, and then also, you know, a recent book by this journalist Vincent Bevins. So how important was the role of the USA and the CIA in particular in this history?
Yeah, of course, it's very important. And I didn't write about it just because I thought that others have already written about it. And I was already doing quite a lot in the book as it was. And so, but there is something, I think I wish I had put in the book. I didn't quite know how to put it, but you know, one way in talking about the U.S., the role of the United States, I think a lot of times we sort of get the impression that the U.S. is ordering Suharto or the army to do things. And I think while the Indonesian army officers knew that this is what the U.S. wanted, they didn't do it just because the U.S. was telling them to do it. They did it because they wanted to prove to the U.S. that they deserved this money. That is, they were trying to serve the U.S. for their own interest in creating this new regime. And they, for this new regime that they were set up, being led by Suharto and the army, they needed foreign aid and foreign investment. So I mentioned a little bit of this in the earlier book on pretext, but there is a kind of element of they're committing the killings as a way of sending a signal to the U.S. That is one of the reasons why the killing, which is so unnecessary, so gratuitous, you know, that the army could have stopped at mass arrests, and in some areas they did. So, but I don't think all the killings can be explained just as a way of sending a signal to the U.S., but certainly some of that push was there. And there's a document from the U.S. Embassy mentioning that there was a fellow from Suharto's group that came to the embassy and asked them, so how much are these dead communists worth to you? What are you going to give us? We're killing the communists. You have to be pleased by this. And this was actually a kind of trick that the Indonesian political elite understood from the 1940s, from the late 1940s, when they attacked the PKI in 1948 and the U.S. helped them put pressure on the Dutch to withdraw. The attack on the PKI in 1951, too, I think, was partly motivated by the idea of impressing upon the U.S. at a certain juncture in Indonesian-U.S. relations that it deserved, Indonesia deserved U.S. aid. So there's always this sort of logic of attack the PKI in order to get help from economic help from the U.S.
Yeah. So to finish up here, and we have taken up a lot of your time, I really appreciate it. But I just want to ask you a personal question. I myself have worked on the history of violence and the history of colonialism and now working on it in the Cold War era. And I realized that as I've, you know, done research on these really horrific historical moments, there's a real psychological impact on me as a researcher studying these subjects. How do you as a researcher take care of yourself when you're dealing with some of the worst aspects of human behavior?
Well, I think actually in doing the research, doing oral interviews with the former political prisoners, I felt what ennobled, meaning I felt like I was meeting people who had faced the worst and had managed to stay sane, were able to talk with me about it, and people who had suffered so much and yet retained their dignity and had this, their life had been a kind of struggle to maintain their dignity. And that, I think, is really, you know, it gives you an idea of how you should live your own life, that and how to be prepared too for something much worse. So I felt like I learned a lot, not just about sort of facts of history or particular stories about what happened in the past too, but about how to cope with these kinds of terrible experiences. And the other thing is, I really do, well, I put it this way, I didn't plan on spending this much time on this research. And so right now I do feel like doing something else. And I'm thinking about working on the Constituante, the Constitutional Assembly in Indonesia. It was from 1956 to 1959, and which is more about the time of debates, a time of discussions, not about the violence. And so I do sort of want to get away from just writing about violence for a while. I think what I've written about is sort of, I've lived with it long enough.
Yeah.
So that's the plan.
Well, we look forward to seeing that work. I'm sure that will be fascinating, and crank out that book. We'll get you back on the podcast. But before we let you go, could you suggest two books for the listeners that related to the subject as thematically or geographically with Indonesia that you strongly recommend?
Well, I think the book by Pramodi Anantatur, which has been translated as The Mute's Soliloquy, I was thinking about it just recently because it was published in Indonesian first 25 years ago. And that was sort of how I got involved in this story too, because I attended the book launch at his house in 1995. And this was one of my first times in Indonesia. And it really opened up a whole new world for me to become more aware of this experience. It was published in Indonesian in two volumes, but the English translation is out as one. It's kind of a selection of the different chapters. The Mute Soliloquy,
right?
And then I think the new book by Vincent Bevans, The Jakarta Method, is also important, especially as a kind of, if read in combination with Buried Histories, to provide more of that international context, as well as sort of international role of the United States in promoting the actions of the Indonesian army as worthy of emulation by other armies around the world as a kind of permanent solution to communism.
Yeah, and as luck would have it, on Wednesday, I'll be interviewing Vincent Bevans about the Jakarta Method for this very podcast. So podcast listeners, stay tuned. So, John, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been very nice.
And congratulations on a really important book. So this has been a conversation with John Roosa of the University of British Columbia about his book, Buried Histories, The Anti-Communist Massacres of 1965-1966 in Indonesia, published by the University of Wisconsin Press in 2020. I'm Michael G. Van of Sacramento State University, and this has been an episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.